Welcome to Pearl Lam Podcast. Today, I would like to introduce Sohair Khan. Sohair, I'm so happy you're here. Can you briefly tell the audience about yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Pearl. Lovely to be here with you. So I am somebody who's worked at the intersection of technology and design for a very long time. I have spent most of my career in the technology sector. I was at Google for over a decade, and I now run an incubator and a think tank called Open Ended. I'm also an academic and a lecturer in a couple of universities here in the UK, and I'm a writer.
You know, I went on your website, Open Ended. What is the Open Ended community? Who are the people that you are building a community on? Because today, everywhere we go, all the technology are talking about community.
Yes, so we started Open Ended really with the goal.
Is it Open Ended? Really?
It's called Open Ended Design. But we started really when I was still working at Google. With the goal of bringing together quite a niche community, which is global, which is creative people and engineers, computer science professionals, working at this intersection of what I call creative technology. So our community is one of creative technologists who define themselves as artists who code or coders who are artists at the same time. It is a growing group of individuals, organizations that feel that there is a fluidity between where their work ends as a creative and melds into building new technologies. The reason I did it was that I felt that there was a gap in defining this community, but also having been at Google for a long time, I felt that I was quite lucky enough to have a seat at the table with my own work because I work for a large company. I was able to define myself as somebody who worked in tech, who cared about art and culture and design, whereas I felt that people on the outside were not getting a seat at the table. And so I started off with a podcast series. And actually, one of your guests, Thomas Heatherwick, it was during COVID. So he was my advisor at the time because I wasn't really sure how to frame it and how to name the people I wanted to bring together. I thought about architects who make impact in positive ways, who use technology, I was getting around myself. And he was like, isn't it about people like yourself? Aren't you telling the stories of people who sit in your world and who maybe people don't know about? And that's how it started out. And it evolved since then to, of course, being a community, but we host conferences, we host events, conversations, we write pieces, we do advisory, really thinking about the future of design and how to implement technology within organizations, within creative practice in new ways.
What do you think? I mean, today everywhere we're talking about AI, right? AI does. What do you think? How is AI going to impact design?
Well, AI is everywhere.
I know, right? Everywhere. And I mean, I can write a letter with it. I can do everything with it.
Right. I mean, in many ways, it changes how we experience the world around us. So I would say fundamentally, one of the conversations we're not having is about how AI affects our own experience of
exactly,
the world and each other.
Exactly, absolutely right.
At the core of it, artificial intelligence is machine learning. It is algorithms which are stacked one on top of the other, mathematics, which is designed to bring us better and more efficient outcomes. So if we want to run through a data set more quickly, we use artificial intelligence or machine learning to get a larger set of outcomes in a shorter amount of time. What's happened since the inception of modern AI about 30 years ago is that it is now much more accessible to all of us. So it went from being a tool used by computer scientists, mathematicians, scientists to apply to large data sets to come to new and more efficient outcomes to being a technology that's actually engaging all of us through devices, through platforms like ChatGPT, through robotics, through what we call embodied intelligence, to something that's really changing, in my opinion, what it means to be human.
So you are saying that it will, I mean, if they can do everything that humans do, where's the creativity going to be? I mean, going to be, you know, creativity. Compassion, creativity is one of the very essential what human can deliver. So are you saying that all these AI would actually taken the human creativity away?
So I think about this a lot, and the short answer is no. Because what is creativity? Creativity is feeling, experience, luck, spontaneity, good luck, bad luck. Creativity comes from all of the lived experiences that we all have that spur our own imagination. But I think it really depends on how we define creativity. If creativity means AI can write a best-selling novel or an award-winning film, probably yes, that's going to be possible, whether now or in a couple of years, if we consider the way we define creativity in these outputs. If it's about critical thinking, if it's about really feeling, embodying one another, considering what makes us feel, where our heart and our soul, you know, there's a huge distance between these two things, the mind and the heart. Then I don't think it's ever going to replace what we experience of the world right now. But these are very open questions. People are very worried. I don't know if you're following the Hollywood writers' strike about, you know, a few months ago even, where both screenwriters and actors in Hollywood had to do a whole negotiation, trade union style negotiation, in which one of the issues at hand was artificial intelligence.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, who's going to take the face of a famous actor and superimpose it for free on, you know, a machine learning built model? It's very possible. So these are conversations we're going to keep having, and technology will be more and more advanced.
I'm always thinking that AI has this intelligence. It's based on data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you have certain data that they cannot farm, so they cannot make appropriate answers, right?
So there's a few things. Is number one is that the data that's right now going into most of the systems that, let's say, are built off of AI that we're familiar with is relatively limited. It's mostly coming from Western countries. Yeah. It's learning off of itself.
Yeah.
And what AI is doing, which is scary and concerning for a lot of us, is that it's interrogating meaning and understanding.
Absolutely.
And so it is limited to mostly a certain context. It's also designed and built with all of the biases of a particular group of individuals, which is engineers and computer scientists, mostly in American-based companies. This is limited. And so the bigger question becomes, what is intelligence? And I think we have to be really careful to separate the word intelligence from AI, because intelligence is not just a large data set pulled
but
out
actually,
of one part of the world.
What you are saying to me now is, because of a limited data that they are farming, they have got all the data from the West. Therefore, susceptible countries like in Asia, what they are doing is when you press the AI, they can condition you about all the Western. I mean, I'm using cultural point of view.
Yeah,
I'm not using anything. So therefore, we will be conditioned to the impact that our evaluation of aesthetic will be completely westernized, like nowadays already because of movies, but it will be even in a more serious way because what they absorb all the data and then they also give it out when we research. We see that every day we see certain and what the AI consider as beautiful. So we say, oh, this is beautiful. So at the end, your children growing up, looking at the same images, they would consider, oh, aesthetic, this is great. I.e. what we are going to have is what I hate is homogeneous culture. It's something that I've been fighting about is homogeneous culture. I think AI is really fantastic because it helps out. It makes things so much more efficient. But if we have to learn, because one of the things that you were saying is to have machine learning, right? If we use the fact that what you will be saying, a machine learning, then all our thinking and everything will become completely westernized in a way is because in China or in Asia or in Pakistan, they have not shared the data, so much data there. So what we are learning, what we are seeing, we will be completely the other side.
Right.
And that's very scary, right?
The point you're making is this, is that the data is learning off of itself. So yeah. The more it learns off of itself, the more it goes down a particular path. And what you'll see in the news, for example, is we're worried about deep fakes, about misinformation in election, about racism and bias as a result of the way these systems are built. What's a much more subtle point is the one that you're making, is that at what point is it giving us meaning and reason? And AI right now is mostly what is available to all of us, built off of text, but also image, as you said.
Image, yeah, absolutely.
And so there becomes certainly, at a very baseline, some sort of confluence of what is right, what is the truth, what is meaning. Even in terms of translation, most of the data that's inputted is in the English language. So even in the translation, you lose, as any of us would, you lose meaning.
Of course, you lose inflection. Of course, definitely.
And so what does this mean for culture? I think this is a huge issue that is very difficult to address. So right now you have a lot of countries in the world, as well as government bodies, looking at regulation and ethics in AI. UNESCO has just had a conference in Slovenia on human-centered AI.
What do you mean by human-centered AI?
What do they mean by human-centered AI? Because what defines a human?
Yeah.
What does it mean to have shared values, shared ethics, a shared conception of what is right and wrong? If you don't have the table, people who come from different cultures, whether it's indigenous cultures, whether it's people who have that sort of rare confluence of what we were talking about earlier, you know, the Chinese experience of Confucianism, Shintoism, Buddhism. There's 2 billion Muslim people in the world. Each of us has had a unique set of experiences. The demographics of the world are shifting to Africa,
Absolutely.
To Asia, to India.
Yeah.
So for sure, if you're not building in their insights, their experiences, their set of feelings about tomorrow,
and the values,
then you definitely have something which is pushing us to go down a path which is very much narrow. Having said that, I actually think that because it is right now a huge shift in numbers, we're going to see a change. We're going to see, in the same way you have Turkish television shows watched all over the world and Mexican soap operas, K-pop.
But it's very different because that is what we watch. And now the AI is not what superficially is actually. I mean, it's changing the way we think, the way we see things, our perception.
Mm-hmm.
So that is much more serious things because, you know, they self-learn, and they also preach. Because as soon as we do the research, as soon as we type the words, they send us all the articles, and they ask, and all the articles, when we read, is all, you know, Western-based, or sometimes it might be completely racial bias. Because, not because they are racist, because they don't have enough data.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is a gap in R&D. There should be R&D in computer science, in AI, in a lot more parts of the world. Secondly, it's a gap in dialogue between governments, obviously, as you and I know, on what is the future of these technologies. And finally, there is a bigger gap, which is of a gap that's never going to be filled. Because as democratized as AI systems get, you know, large language models, which is what powers ChatGPT and powers now a lot of the internet, those are going to become smaller, cheaper to build, easier to access, but they're not going to be accessible at all.
Hold on. Because now AI is only, I mean, we have, we discussed about it. The hardware AI is most prominent in China, but the software AI, like ChatGPT, is all in America. And like in Asia, which other countries can build this? And also, like in China, we don't have this semiconductor, this nano chip. So in the future, when we talk about advancement, I mean, on the software, it would be still in the West. So are we saying that? Because in the West, they have absorbed all the data. So they will, I mean, we, no matter where you're born from India, Pakistan, China, you will come out, just have Western values because the way you're trained by a computer, because eventually you don't go to school. You will be going and seeing from your computer screen and everything. You don't even need a teacher, right? And whatever we're learning, we're just learning to be, you know, the values
I think so, but I think that's like
it's very scary, you know.
It is scary, but we need a lot more of what we're creating today. We need more conversation, more education, more culture, and more celebration of uniqueness. And that,
no, because I always believe what is the most important for young children or for any one of us,
yeah,
is to be individualistic.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, you know, I know that human beings also have this herd. We love to be in groups. We love, you know, this herd culture. But you need to be very strong, need to have confidence, determination to be individual.
Yeah, of course. But we do live in a moment of disempowerment for most young people.
Absolutely.
As you know, it's difficult to see your future, and you have access 24 hours a day. 8 billion people in the world pretty much have a smartphone right now, or access to the internet in some capacity.
But and internet information
to be addictive.
Yeah, but don't you think that, you know, a lot of information in the internet, whether it is social media or whatever, I mean, we're talking about fake news, we're talking about that, and we're talking about a younger generation who's not interested to read newspaper. They're much more interested to get news from social media. And all that is spreading a lot of, you know, not very objective point of view.
For sure. And we go into our echo chambers and we hear the same thing over and over again.
Echo chambers, absolutely.
And we live in a world of course, very polarized politics, which impact many billions of people. It's not just
the
geopolitical
situation is not very beneficial for the younger generation.
And to the point that you raised earlier on the physical, you know, we call it the technology stack. What is a stack of AI right now? It starts from the ground up. AI is not just you playing around, you know, with stability and coming up with a new drawing or a made-up image. AI is about resource extraction. It's about pulling silicon, lithium, rare earths out of the ground. It's about data centers that are massive carbon emitters. It's about building data centers next to deep and cold American rivers, because the amount of heat that's generated because of large language models is basically incalculable in many ways. And of course, it's about geopolitics. It's about trade. It's about, as you mentioned, countries hoarding GPUs, which are the microchips used to power these technologies. So we should not forget that whilst we have this conversation right now about, you know, what is the regulation around these technologies?
Yes.
Who defines what messages are being sent? How do we make sure that there's universal values built into them and that more of us have cultural access to inputting into them? Actually, it's a very real and physical industry. It's a very old-fashioned industry in some ways, because it's built off of old-school extraction, industrialization, manufacturing.
And actually, that also hurts climate, isn't it?
Of course, it has a massive impact on climate.
Yeah.
Technology companies are probably the largest purchaser of carbon credits in the world because,
they use a lot of energy.
Yeah, and they're trying to, many of them, to be carbon neutral. So they actually have a huge impact on our environment, and it's very difficult to map and to track where it is, how much is it, and where is it going to disappear. Part of this is because we're worried about efficiency, as you know. We're trying to figure out what happens next with our economies and inflation, what happens tomorrow between two big countries, how do we make better information faster, and we are lacking a consideration for what does it mean for our children, what does it mean for the future of the workplace, and finally, what does it mean for the future of feeling, communication, family? If we are to survive, you know, through climate change, through the temperature increase of waters by 1.5 degrees Celsius into the future, what kind of world do we want to build? And until we start to have real conversations about these issues at a leadership level, we're still leaving in the hands of corporate boards decisions on our future.
Right? Well, there must be discussion about these climate changes, about the impact of and of technology on that. Well, how was it, you know, do you go to any of these...
Yes, I had a couple of talks at Davos, and I went to a bunch of conversations. And Davos is amazing because you have people from around the world in conversation. The greatest concern is obviously climate. The other greatest concern, which was interesting, was war, because we have at least 3 to 4 major wars in the world right now, and that is of concern to CEOs and business leaders.
Asia is peaceful. so far.
Asia is peaceful so far.
So far, so far.
And hope it stays that way.
Yeah.
And then, of course, AI. You know, I think you could tack AI onto the name of a country now. Like, it was literally the topic of every conversation.
I mean, especially the last year, everything is AI. And you mean with the chat, what's coming. Everything is talking about AI.
But you know who had the most insightful conversations and comments? Of course, there was people much smarter than myself, much more important than myself there. But it's the academics. It's researchers from Stanford, from MIT, from Tsinghua University in China, having conversations. Oh, some from IIT India on the design of these technologies.
Because design of these technology, or the worries or the concern about the AI, the risk of having too high, high technology AI that would damage.
Can I be honest? There was those conversations, but it was a lot more
even the movie.
But a lot more of the conversations are right now around how can we channel these technologies to do good. And I think part of it is that maybe it's what I attended. Part of it is Davos is a business, gathering.
Exactly.
How can we use this to make more money, to cut costs, to be more efficient, which is all fine. I think that right now on the risks of AI, there's a concern that very few people in the world understand where these technologies are going. And the truth, of course, is that if we leave them to evolve without any regulation, we're going to be able to see exponential harms from these technologies. I think that that conversation is actually going to be, let's say, quote-unquote, solved at an R&D level. I think we need the makers.
Can you build compassion into AI?
So
can you do an algorithm that can define compassion, that can equate to compassion?
Do you know that if I pinched your arm right now and I asked you how much it hurt, the only way I could quantify that is by your telling me. If I say
one to ten,
you'd say five, right? And if some, like there was a rugby player, he'd say two. The issue becomes this, is what's the relativism? What are we creating? How does it make me feel versus a vulnerable teenager versus somebody who feels isolated versus an American computer engineer? And so I think the conversations we should be having, you mentioned the word community in the beginning, is how can we solve in a more thoughtful way for groups of individuals that we can support. Artists are doing amazing work on this. You have Su-Gwen Chung, who's an incredible artist. She's Canadian. She's right now based in London, working with robots to consider the conversation.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She's
you
incredible.
Must introduce me.
I will introduce
you
today. I
would love to meet.
She's brilliant, beautiful, smart, eloquent. And her artistic practice is based on a conversation with a robot where they're teaching one another. What does it mean to paint and to create? Where is the difference between the aesthetic and the functional? How can we consider technology in new ways? How can we step outside of ourselves? And then, of course, there's philosophers working on this question of consciousness.
Philosophers are very important to work on these and these transformations, because what is the meaning of doing all that?
Yeah.
I mean, these are things that I think we need to think about it, and it will be great if you can teach an AI to think about these. These are knowledges which need to be shared. And I understand why you have your open-ended community.
Thank you for saying that. So on the philosophy, here's another really important conversation. Is so far, the way we're designing these systems is out of a paradigm that came 400 years ago, the age of the Enlightenment. We're building around a very Western-centric model of philosophy. What does it mean to be successful? What is progress? What if we were to step outside of that and actually use AI as a new tool to add new windows and walls to the mind as architecture, and to say, what if we considered other perspectives, the more than human, other species, but also, obviously, other cultures, other languages, other sets of meaning? And that is where I think we start to have a really interesting and positive conversation around what is philosophy? You know, which culture defines what is right, what is wrong, what is meaningful? And it isn't so esoteric.
But the philosophy is only come up with your everyday life, because so you have Western's philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And these philosophers stay within that parameter, the life, and then they come up with their philosophy. Obviously, Chinese philosophy and Western philosophy, it's different, because all Western philosophy is the roots is the Greek philosophers.
Of course. Yeah. And it should be different. And this is where I think we should be owning the AI narrative in other parts of the world. It's good to copy and build, but what about changing the way we engage with this and seeing it as a new way of building for the future? So one of the talks I did in Davos was on spiritual intelligence and AI. And
spiritual intelligence on AI?
Yeah.
Wow, how? Well, how do you link the spiritual intelligence in AI?
I was in conversation with a friend of mine who is a healer. She's a teacher of Kabbalah. She's from Israel.
I meet a lot of healers. Yeah,
I love healers.
I love healers and, as well, because we're Asians.
Because we're Asian, and also maybe we're seeking. As Ram Dass, who is not Asian, who studied at Harvard, worked with LSD, and he studied, you know, spirituality. So the question became, what is spirituality? Who defines it? And secondly, where is that gap between what is cognitive intelligence, which is, let's say, AI, versus creative intelligence, the intelligence of your body, and the intelligence of what you believe in? 84% of the world defines itself or self-identifies as religious. That is something we don't talk about in technology companies, really. It's not how we think about building algorithms and models.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't mean that we have to solve for it or fix it. It's more that if we are to consider new ethical regimes, new value systems, how we keep our own cultures intact, we can't pretend that it's just about language or it's just about pictures on the wall.
No, it's not. It's much deeper than that. That philosophy, that more, that value system.
Exactly.
The value system is so different from Asia to the West. So all that is fundamental. But that fundamental is not learned by your AI.
No. Well, it's not going to learn what it doesn't want to learn. And also...
I don't think that they don't want to learn. It's just that we don't want to feed them too much data.
I think we should be thinking about where... I think this is a moment where we should be, especially in Asia, frankly, even in Africa, it's a moment of empowerment. I met recently the Minister of Culture from Nigeria, and she's actually working with the Minister of Technology to think about where there can be a confluence between their arts and their culture, their food, all of the different...
I just did a podcast with this really amazing young artist who's also a DJ, and she graduated from Stanford, Koto and all that. And she is exploring African philosophies.
Amazing.
Which is just by oral transmission.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like family, you know, passing through. And it's really amazing because she's saying that who said that there's no African philosophy? So she was, it was very interesting.
Well, I'm going to listen to this. I would love to hear it because exactly this, who tells us what is right and wrong?
Exactly.
But equally, we have to be careful of like tagging too many things in, is saying that, you know, I will come to your country and tell you that indigenous people, frankly, have a voice that I want to program into AI. Or we've been looking at animals. So there's a lot of research done on whales and how whales communicate using AI to translate the voices of whales. On the one hand, that's very interesting. On the other hand, this is a human tendency to anthropomorphize, to add, to create
meaning.
Where it doesn't really belong to us.
No.
And that sense of where can we let go and really consider where the environment can be supported.
Because I think at the end is different cultures we have to respect.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to respect different cultures, but we have to celebrate differences. I mean, or else the world would never be at peace.
Exactly. I'm doing a project with Tom Dixon, your friend,
yeah,
on marine intelligence. You know, we're looking
fantastic
at new material design for a project that he has worked on for 10, 15
really?
Years, as Tom does, on coral and how you can use
coral. Many coral is completely damaged.
The coral reef
is completely damaged.
Exactly.
That is why you have the shark attack.
Exactly. And also coastal erosion.
Yeah.
A loss of biodiversity.
Absolutely.
And his project is beautiful. It's really about using coral as a material that could eventually replace concrete to protect coastal shorelines in the world. So we change the way we're investing in protecting our planet by using natural materials. And so there was a long conversation about how do we use technology? How can we use this to make this better and faster and more efficient? But actually what we realized was that It was about the coral growing and the way that it's been trained to grow by Tom and his project, which will take time. But where technology could be helpful was in doing something that's actually very difficult to do, which is to map the ocean floor. And so we're looking at how you can build a digital twin, which is basically like a snapshot of a particular part of the ocean, which will help us to track and measure over time biodiversity numbers, water temperatures, the growth rate of coral, and to project into the future how we might build that. So it's not technology solving
because
anything.
Because I thought most of the coral reef has been destroyed is because the water pollution.
Right.
Because the water has been so polluted. Every big containers, boat have all the gas. So slowly and slowly, all the coral reef disappeared.
Pollution and water temperature rise, which is
so
both because of
can be
pollution.
Help? You know, we still want our engine to be moving. So what can be help to preserve the corals and clean the water?
You have to regenerate. You have to add more coral also. Cleaning the water is a much bigger issue, especially
big
when you look at
issue.
Oceans.
The ocean is so big.
I think Yves Behar is doing a cool project on cleaning the ocean.
Oh, come on, look at
it,
Japan.
Yeah.
Japan is pouring has been pouring the nuclear water into the deep ocean.
Yeah.
Did any of the countries stop them? No.
The reason I'm telling you this example is that you don't have to solve for everything. When you talk about design and technology, you can say you care about expertise, you care about R&D, you care about craft, you care about, let's say, material, and then you want to consider new ways of engaging with challenges in ways that are unique. And the power of artists, creatives, designers is always this, is that you'll see the world a little bit differently. You ask different questions of yourself and of other people. And so when we think about culture going forward, when we think about Asia, whatever, religion, spirituality, we have to think about what makes us different. And that is what we can channel into technology. And unfortunately, we're in a position where technology companies are able to really, at this point, saturate our experience of the internet, of tech, of our phones in a particular way. But it doesn't mean that we can't use our numbers, our sheer numbers, young people, people outside of the West. You know, right now we're living and working in what is now being called a post-Western world of the whole world shifting, the axis of truth, the axis of who should define our value systems is moving. That's a fact. Outside of just a Western narrative. So for innovation, does it have to be built and designed in the same way as AI is being built and designed in the West? Of course, we can think of new ways of doing it, but we have to do it in a patient way. And we also have to be okay with it being smaller than what we're being told success is.
You know what is amazing is when I'm talking to you, is I was thinking when we talk about differences, now we all talk about how important about differences. Mm-hmm. I mean, decades ago, only a few decades ago, the whole world is manufacturing robots. We go to school, everybody wants to be the same. And now, I mean, with all these technology coming in, with the world is consistently changing, now we recognize differences is actually very important. Important to the way that we learn from each other. And hopefully with this AI technology, we're not talking about invasion, but we're talking about how a technology can help us to live and to understand each of the culture better.
Of course. Imagine it as a portal into our own consciousness, and that's how we should be treating it.
Consciousness is really, you know,
how can we be collaborators with these technologies to have new ideas, to think about things that we wouldn't have thought about before? And I do think that this whole kind of the industrial mindset, right, of separating, of siloing. Think of Leonardo da Vinci. He was an artist and an architect.
It's multi-discipline, but when art, after the Second World War, well, completely changes, because what has happened is they want to put everything in a box. Just remember Bauhaus. Bauhaus is about multi-discipline. You put writers, musician, you know, a poet, painter. They all are together because it's that multi-discipline. Which is why you have your community.
Of course. And this is why...
This is why, you know, it's really beautiful because you can inspire each other. And by discussing with each other, you may find out a better solution.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, one of the things you don't realize is how you can empower each other.
Absolutely right.
And
absolutely right.
We don't, you know, we talk a lot about mentors. We talk about people that we can look up to. But actually, in my career, my mentors have always been people sort of my age group who are in completely different industries.
No, I always thought that parents who always tell the children, oh, you can become like blah, blah, blah. You can, you know, have a hero. You can become like this. Is, you know, following your mentors. I think this is completely wrong. Mm-hmm. Why don't you teach children to be themselves? To actually grow up understanding themselves and be strong enough to be yourself. Right. No parents has ever asked any children to be themselves. They always say, oh, this person is like this. You know, you always have this mentorship or this hero that you want to be like. Why? Why can't we be ourselves? Why can't any parents encourage children to be themselves?
I think it's about listening.
And I think it's so important.
I think also there's like a bigger issue that comes from that is that we do have a lot of invisible people in the world right now. We saw that during COVID. You know, it was great if you had nature or a nice house. But if you were in a small home, if you were a migrant worker in India and someone said, go home, where do you go? And the same with technology. It's created a whole greater ecosystem of totally invisible people who are not serving.
Absolutely.
And so when you talk about children, how can we raise young people wherever they are to feel that they're special, they matter, and they should be empowered to speak up, to have a voice? That is
so important.
Yeah. I mean,
not just now about, you know, this world with a technology, but even when I was growing up. I mean, we're put in schools, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has to behave like the other person. No one has ever told me, none of my friends have ever told their children, be happy, be yourself. The most important thing is understand yourself, be yourself, and love yourself. Yeah. That's the most important
and
thing.
And be kind, and people
and
will
be kind,
kind
of
too.
Course.
I love the idea. In the UK, they have this concept called a forest school. I have a little goddaughter and she's in one. And you go and you play around. You spend all of your time in forests and in nature and in trees. And you learn to listen and to feel.
How
and it's
beautiful.
Cold. And every day is different. And if it rains, you all have to go in a certain direction. If there's an emergency, you have a way of working. They work with things like knives, things that we never give to children. They're trusted to decide for themselves in ways that are very much about feeling and experiencing. And it's not to say regular school is good or bad, but I think there's something
this
there
is
about
very
trusting
important because
children.
It gives them confidence. Confidence is so important.
Yeah, and to trust themselves.
Yeah, to trust themselves,
and
absolutely.
I think in my own work, in my own career, you know, there's every single day you question yourself. And I've realized, you know, if you don't follow a path, you didn't follow a path I didn't. You kind of try and find your own way. And you have to seek out people who can guide you, who can hold your hand, who can inspire you more than anything. And in that, you have to learn to trust yourself, but also to trust other people. And that is about going beyond having a job, getting your salary,
absolutely.
Listening to your boss. It's about saying, if you're going to pull me out, I was reading Osho this morning, the idea of what does it mean to take a risk and live bravely? And that is something that nobody teaches us.
That is about confidence. You have to have the self-trust. And I think a lot of school system just rip away this basic needs. Without self-trust, you don't have confidence.
Yeah.
And you have confidence, you cannot enter the big wild world.
Well, it's also the ranking. So I'm not an expert on this, but in Finland, they were actually the number one educational primary and secondary school country ranked in the world. And in recent years, their ranking has dropped because they decided as a government to focus more on critical skills, on asking why and how, and not just getting the big best grades because they realized with technology, with social media, the skills they needed to build were about asking questions. And with tech, with like this your and my job in 10 years or 20 years or the whole team here, our jobs are going to change. The truth of AI is that it's going to take away a lot of jobs. It's going to change through automation a lot of how industry is run, how manufacturing is conducted, travel, transportation. We're going to be in self-driving cars in not a very long time. What does that mean for young people? It means that they're going to have to find new ways of having value. In some ways, it's going to liberate them. They can be creative. They can build new worlds. But they're not going to be able to figure out ways of surviving without confidence and trust, but also Absolutely. Without critical thinking.
Critical thinking is very important, but I don't think many schools
No.
has taught about critical thinking. I mean, that would be a complete change of our education system.
Yeah, I have a longer term project on this. It's like, how do we build a new kind of school where it is multidisciplinary and multicultural, and it's decentralized? You know, you don't have to be in one country, one place.
No, decentralized is important. Let's talk about what you are talking about decolonization and decarbonize. No, that's right. Explain that to the audience, which is very interesting.
Well, I learned these words actually recently. I started to teach a course a few years ago at Central St. Martin's in London, which is a very famous fashion school. It's also a very important school for art, architecture. And it was right next to the Google offices. So I spent a lot of time there. I did a lot of collaborations with them. And I taught this course, I started to teach at the beginning of COVID, on spatial practice, which is, let's say, architecture, our experience of the mm-hmm. world around us, and digital technology. And I designed a course to work with young architecture students to consider how the experience of our world is actually shaped in many ways by the thoughts in your head because of your phone, by your consciousness being split across your WhatsApp and your Instagram and your Facebook, but also on a real design perspective on some of the conversations we've just had. What is a data center? How do you build it? How should it be? How should we envision the architecture of a large language model? How can we consider new ways of building and designing? And then finally, of course, how can you channel emerging technologies into design and building? And the course was framed around decolonization and decarbonization. Decolonization is a very loaded term right now because of the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. It represents...
Because they were all colonies and being split up.
Well, the legacy of imperialism...
Oh, I'm from a colony.
Well, so am I. I'm from two. My mom's from India, my dad's from Pakistan. And the reason I'm from two countries is because of the British Empire.
We're the last colony being liberated.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Yeah.
There's most of the world's wars right now, Sudan, of course, in the Middle East,
Sudan.
Are in countries that are still bearing a lot of the weight of their colonial legacy. And, of course, there's a whole West versus others conversation. But what is decolonization in diverse countries? We're lucky to be in the UK where many people live side by side from different religions, ethnicities.
I truly believe that UK is a melting pot of different cultures.
It is. That's where we're in a museum, which is, you know, thinking about the future of design. Having said that, there's very few critical frameworks that I had working in technology in Google around what does it mean to address issues of race, gender, ethnicity, identity, accessibility, inclusion, and on the decarbonization side, ecology, environment, sustainability. We don't have those frameworks because they have to come from academia. They have to come from research.
However,
and they have to come from doing.
You know, there are so many articles written about inclusiveness, nearly, the last 5 years. So it is an issue that people are talking about.
Yeah.
And decolonization, I mean, this word has been going on for like decades.
Yeah.
But I think the real impact now, you see all these Middle East crises, then you really see what the hell.
Well, I think it comes down to inequality. We have inequality between economies and within economies. So at the core of it, people feel socially excluded, economically excluded, and politically excluded. And I think that's a very real conversation for the next generation. You know, there's Generation Alpha, which is born, I think, after 2010, I should check the numbers. But let's say we look at Pakistan. They have experienced flooding, they've experienced COVID, they've experienced the evolution of the internet, all of the Western issues of that, loneliness, isolation, and they're looking at a climate crisis which seems insurmountable. How do we confront these issues countries that are poor?
You know, when I read about Pakistan, when I look at Pakistan, okay, beside all these different problems, you also have your religious problem, your inequality, your gender inequality, and all that. And today you have a big political issues.
Yeah.
So with all that coming, do you still go back to Pakistan?
I visit. My parents live there. They live in Islamabad. And I'm very involved with an organization called the Himalayan Wildlife Foundation. It's a conservation charity that's basically protects the national parks in the northern areas of Pakistan. And I find that part of it is privilege. I can go back and I'm safe. My parents support my working, my traveling.
This
my
is
having...
really weird, rare, right?
Yeah,
in a Muslim country.
Yeah.
And you're not even supposed to have education. You should be married now.
I should be married.
Yeah, you should
That's
have
a fact.
Been married.
I agree now. On that. I should be married. But on beyond that,
yeah. It is arranged marriage is not so simple.
Arranged marriage is usually more successful, but that's a separate conversation. I think what Pakistan represents is the future problems or ongoing problems of a lot of the world right now. Populism, extremism, absolutely. Isolation, economic decline, geopolitical chaos, and a lack of a governance structure because there's actually an identity that was formed 75 years ago in a country that was carved out of India by the British Empire without a plan. 20 million people died in the creation of an independent India and a newly state of Pakistan.
Before what I read up, because I wasn't there, that Indians and Pakistanians, they live very happily with each other.
Everyone was fine.
Never have been a problem.
Thousands of years.
Yeah, why all that happened? It's just so sad.
Yeah. You know, a conversation I had recently, I don't know if it's something you've thought about, is around what does it mean to reflect on your past? You know how South Africa, Rwanda had the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions,
Colombia
had something similar with the rebels. And nobody has done that in South Asia. And I have been wondering a lot about, maybe it's too late, but the idea of what does it mean to reflect on your past, and can we create spaces? Maybe that's where technology can help, because we inherit trauma, we inherit wounds. That's a fact. You know, your DNA carries pain. So
I
many
think
other
the
things.
Chinese way or the Asian way on our part is very different. Like,
what is it?
And like Cambodia, you have the pop, the popol, the popol janet. A genocide. I met some of the Cambodians even in Paris. Mm-hmm. They decided that, you know, they don't have revenge. They just forget about it. They start a new life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think most of them are Chinese, but Chinese has a, I don't know, it's good or bad, but mm-hmm. Chinese, whatever, they never want to mention anything about trauma.
Mm-hmm. No, we don't either. We hate talking
They want
about
to be a hero.
Mind.
Even if you're a victim, you want to show yourself as a hero. So you never hear about anything. Like, you know, the older generation, actually, they couldn't even visit Japan because of the massacre during the Sino-Japanese War. Of course, the younger generation, we all love Japan. And there was always this problem between Japan and China and all that. But
I think there's here like a lot of what we
don't
carry,
have that. Yeah.
Belonging, heartbreak, and how you can separate. And that's very interesting. It's very cultural, right? Choices that we make.
Yeah.
I think one thing that is a fact, possibly a result of technology, social media, even though if you look at the numbers, you know, a lot has been written about this by people like Steven Pinker.
Yeah.
We live in a non-violent world compared to 100 years ago. We have access to, you know, we have lower child mortality, less wars. But we do live in an age of loneliness, and we live in an age of anxiety.
Yes, absolutely right.
And that
anxiety and loneliness
around
is,
the world.
Yeah.
And so when we consider the young generation, the one I mentioned, Generation Alpha, Where do they go next? What do they remember and what do they forget? How do we consider how we can empower them to believe in themselves, to be stronger, to connect one another, and to create new outcomes without losing their own language, their own culture, their own set of, you know, what their grandparents should be teaching them? This is the problem of our times, and it is something that I think governments should be thinking about, because it cannot be solved by individuals. They should be in the room. They should be sitting in the meeting. So when I started open-ended, I used to feel like I'd be like, you know, relatively, I try and look older, and it would be all these like very successful men at the table. And my friends who are doing the work, who are architects, designers, computer scientists, engineers, researchers, were behind the scenes. And I used to feel really guilty, first of all. And I used to think, I don't want to hear any of these CEOs telling me what they think, like in Davos, frankly.
Yeah.
I wasn't interested. I want to meet the artists. I want to go in the basement of the museum and meet the curator of the fish at the Natural History Museum. I want to know the people who have the insight, the knowledge, and the heart to be doing what they do every single day. And that's where we need to be bringing young people to the table. And it's whether it's in a conversation like this, whether it's in government, policy making. You know, I recently met somebody who said, oh, it causes a bit of friction because it wastes a bit of time and they're too woke and they have a problem with everything. Shouldn't we be made to feel a little bit uncomfortable for the world that feels too easy and too simple? Shouldn't we leave the room with a question? One of the girls on my team is dyslexic and she's taught me a lot about neurodiversity. We always have. I always have to spend 10 more minutes asking her why she said something that she said. And same with her. And we leave feeling like we've each learned something. So should we not change how we think about learning? And also finally, and very important for technology, time. So in your culture, you have 10-year plans, 20-year plans. Mm. In most religions, you think in terms of lifetimes and lifetimes afterwards. Why do we think in terms of quarterly cycles? Why are we worrying about what happens in a year's time? How do we change? There's a concept, cathedral thinking, which is used a lot in design now. What's 1,000 years from now? Should we not be worrying about that? It doesn't matter if we're not allowed. And that is where the value, I think, system really matters. What matters? Is it today, or is it your children, or is it the planet? Is it the tree that'll survive a few hundred years? Or is it worrying about how much money you or I have and where?
I'm happy that you are in several advisory board.
Thank you for saying
that. You shake them up. Thank you, Suhail, for joining me. It has been such an interesting encounter. We must continue to talk and to speak to each other.
Thank you, Pearl.
I'm learning a lot from you.
I've loved meeting you. Thank you.
I love meeting you.